Nice job.
I will call the case for the third case. The third case on today's oral argument calendar is number A19-782, State of Minnesota versus Michael Edward White, the defendant, and Midwest Bonding LLC, which is the plaintiff in this appeal. The appellate record reflects that there was no responsive brief filed in this appeal. The court issued an order pursuant to Rule 142.03, saying that the court will proceed to decide the case on the merits. We'll hear 15 minutes of oral argument from appellant, and then the case will be submitted.
Good morning.
Good morning. Counsel, you may approach and begin. Please identify yourself, and you can then present your argument.
May it please the court. My name is Jim McGeaney, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Midwest Bonding, LLC. Tell the court tough act to follow. My case is not nearly as interesting as the one you just heard, but important to my client. We're here on an appeal from an order forfeiting three separate bail bonds, a somewhat unusual procedure where the district court issued a single order covering three criminal court files and three separate bail bonds, but nevertheless, forfeiting all the bonds which are at issue before your honors this morning. I would like to start out with pointing out to the court that in its order, the district court invited appellant to request a hearing to address the forfeiture order and then summarily denied the request for a hearing, saying that appellant hadn't presented any new evidence to warrant a hearing. And as this court's aware, and I think Judge Jessen actually about 2 years ago pointed out to me in a case you may not recall, Your Honor, but the fact that cases like these tend to come before this court on what was called a skinny record, and our opportunity to present testimony and evidence into the record was denied by the district court.
Mr. McGeaney, before you go further, could you please tell me the amounts of those bonds?
I can, Your Honor. So in court file number CR-16-11051, which was the file that there was a conviction in, the bond was $40,000. In file CR-15-28151, which was ultimately dismissed, and I'll address that, the bond was $30,000. And in court file CR-17-6334, which was also ultimately dismissed, the bond was $50,000. Those are all 27 court files in Hennepin County.
And were all of those bail bonds issued by your client?
They were. Okay. There was another bond issued by another bond company that's not an issue before this court in the interim between when the defendant was apprehended and then posted a bond and then failed to appear again for his sentencing hearing. That bond was forfeited as well. I don't know the status of that bond.
Can I just follow up on a question?
Because certainly.
That was a question I had looking at the district court's order, and I'm looking at the district court's order when it looked at the second factor on the fault and willfulness of the defendant. And the district court says, based upon the facts that the defendant was absent twice from court with his whereabouts unknown, and then goes on to another one. So it says that this factor weighs heavily against reinstatement. Were both of those absences related to the bonds your client? Because I thought one wasn't, and that's what made me question
it. You're correct, Your Honor. No, the second absence from the court was based on a bond filed by a competitor, after the defendant was in custody, our client wouldn't post another bond for him, so he got a competitor to post that bond. He failed to appear again, was apprehended like a month later, and then ultimately sentenced on that file.
So do you have, I don't remember you addressing this specifically in your brief, but, you know, do you have thoughts about whether the district court, when considering the fault or willfulness of the defendant, ought to be looking at an absence from court that wasn't related to your bond?
I think you're right, Your Honor, and, you know, I'll concede my brief wasn't my best work in this case. For reasons I won't go into. But yes, there's a couple of things I didn't address in my brief I'd like to address this morning. One is that, you know, the Supreme Court in Storkamp addresses that very issue, that, you know, willfulness of a defendant shouldn't automatically outweigh the good faith efforts of the surety. And in this case, it appears that the district court didn't consider in the second Shetsky factor any of the good faith efforts made by appellant, including the fact that the defendant was back in custody on the appellant's bonds, and then the second failure to appear is not attributable to Midwest. So I think the court erred in that second Shetsky factor. I would like to point out that the district court really only held the first two Shetsky factors against our client in this case. The court concedes that the third factor favored reinstatement slightly. I don't know that that's a test that either this court or the Supreme Court has ever used the adjective, whether a factor slightly favors, but in any case, maybe they have. And then the court in the fourth factor says it's neutral. I would argue, and I did in my brief, that the defendant's been sentenced. There's no response from the state, either in the district court, nor even in the initial petition, there was no submission by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office regarding our original petition to discharge the bonds. There's been no showing of prejudice. And I would argue to this court that there is no prejudice in this case. There's plenty of opinion from this court and the Supreme Court that the prejudice in a bond reinstatement matter is loss of evidence, loss of witnesses, inability to prosecute the defendant. There's no evidence in this record that the state's been prejudiced, and I think the district court erred as a matter of law in deciding that that factor was even neutral. I think that the record reflects that factor weighs in favor of discharge of these bonds.
Well, and I noticed that in our State versus Raymer decision, which I know is an unpublished decision, where there wasn't a showing by the state of prejudice, we said this factor favors reinstatement of the bonds as opposed to being neutral. Do you have any, I know in your brief you said that where there was no showing of prejudice, that should weigh in favor of reinstatement, as we did in Raymer. Do you have any published opinions you can point us to, or anything else?
I argued Raymer before this court.
I recall.
And I don't think there is a published opinion that offers that. I mean, there's not a ton of published opinions on bail bond reinstatements in Minnesota. But I think the opinions that are published all state that the prejudice needs to be shown by the state. It's probably error. I think it is error for a district court to make its own conclusion and say, I find this prejudice without any showing affirmatively by the state. So I don't have a published opinion to cite to you other than the opinions that say the type of prejudice that needs to be shown is loss of evidence, destruction of evidence, loss of witnesses, and those types of things. I think we can infer that that's the standard. So I agree with the court that, like in Raymer, there's no prejudice here. And I think the district court erred in that fourth factor. I also want to point out briefly that there's $80,000 worth of bonds that were forfeited in cases that were dismissed. And I'm not sure how the district court can conclude that it's neutral, the prejudice factor is neutral in cases that were ultimately dismissed. Those are the files abbreviated 28151 and 6334. Again, it was kind of unusual because the district court issued one order regarding all three of the bonds rather than address them individually and did its Shetsky analysis for a case where the defendant was sentenced in addition to cases where the cases were dismissed and didn't differentiate between the two types of cases. So again, I think the district court erred again as a matter of law. There can't be prejudice in a case that's been dismissed.
So the amount of bail bonds total we're looking at here that were...
It's $120,000 that was forfeited. And, you know, this court and the Supreme Court in Shetsky, it's it's well established that the primary purpose here is to ensure the administration of justice. I concede there was a long delay between the defendant's plea and his sentencing, but he had already pleaded guilty. The district court didn't even forfeit the bonds until Midwest and law enforcement found the defendant. He was back in custody, appeared before the district court. That's when the district court ordered the bonds forfeited, when they had that aha moment, I guess, and said, oh, I forgot to forfeit these bonds 6 months ago when this defendant failed to appear. Askeland, I believe, is a case where the defendant was at large for 7 months. I think the factor that this court considered, if not the Supreme Court, was the fact that the defendant had already pleaded guilty, and it was just a delay in imposing sentence. I concede there's a lengthy delay in imposing sentence. In the district courts of Minnesota, in my practice in criminal defense law, most of the time the prosecutors, and the state took no position here, they don't really care when the defendants serve their sentence. As long as they serve their sentence, in other words, as long as they satisfy that Minnesota theory of retribution for the crime and you serve your time, I don't see any pushback from the state about when. So the defendant I think he had 30 months in prison for his offense. That was the ultimate sentence in file 11051. And I have the Mensis records as my addendums. So the defendant was ultimately sentenced, and I want to stay behind the mic, to 30 months. So I appreciate that he effectively delayed. I didn't bring my cheaters, but it was a 30-month commit to the Commissioner of Corrections ultimately in December 2018. The defendant serving his sentence, the justice has been administered in this case. And so I'm not aware of any case law that supports the district court's finding that the delay in sentencing the defendant prejudiced the state, especially absent the state making any showing or even coming and arguing that they're prejudiced. And that maybe, I can't tell the court why the state's not responded to these petitions nor this appeal, but it's a reasonable inference that they don't perceive that they've been prejudiced. The defendant's, he's taken into custody and he's serving his sentence. So really the first two Shetsky factors are the ones that I think tipped the district court in this case, I'm presuming they were, and I think the court erred in its analysis of those two factors.
I just want to be clear on one thing. I mean, you mentioned in your brief as well in your argument that the district court did not permit you to have a hearing despite your request.
Correct.
But you're not arguing that that's a reason for reversal. I mean, that's not the way I read your brief. I just want to be clear about that.
I think in the very least, I'm asking this court to reverse the district court, just to be clear, in order that the bonds be reinstated and discharged. But if this court's not inclined to grant that relief, at least certainly in the two files that were dismissed, I think the appropriate remedy from this court is reversal and a remand for an order to discharge those bonds. If this court's not inclined to reverse the district court and file CR 16-11051, and again, I apologize, I'm arguing three cases in one appeal, which is unusual for me, but that's the order we got. So that case, I think the appropriate relief is also reversal, but at the very least, a remand to make a factual record about the fact that the defendant, you know, the efforts that we have made, we have an affidavit in the file, apparently not good enough for the district court. I'm not sure what the district court's reasoning is, where they didn't consider or even discuss the efforts that Midwest made in trying to apprehend Mr. White. And
well, the district court did find that factor weighed slightly in favor of reinstatement. So, it seems to me the district court did address that.
I agree, Your Honor.
I don't know whether we can conflate two and three, because two is the good faith efforts of the bonding company as measured by the fault or willfulness of the defendant. I don't know how anybody could make a good faith argument that Mr. Defendant in this case wasn't willfully disobeying the court's orders to appear. I mean, they found him hiding in a wall when they originally arrested him, or eventually did. And the first factor is, you know, the cause, purpose, and length of the defendant's absence. None of those have to do with the good faith of Midwest in trying to get him back. And the court ruled that both of those favor forfeiture. How is that an abuse of discretion, looking at the facts of this case?
Well, in the cases that I've reviewed and that this court has decided, the purpose of bail is also the first factor.
Right.
And this court's found on numerous occasions that once a defendant pleads guilty, if there's a delay, even a significant delay, between the plea and the sentencing, as long as he's back in custody and sentenced, that the purpose of bail has been satisfied.
So the prompt administration of justice shouldn't factor into that?
I don't think it does. I think once if the defendant's in custody and serving his sentence, then justice has happened. And that the defendant maybe delayed his sentencing date for a significant period of time shouldn't be held against the surety, because the cases where the administration of justice has not been satisfied, most of the cases from this court and the Supreme Court are cases where the defendant's not ever been found. Mm-hmm. And the surety's coming in and saying, you should discharge this bond because whatever reason, we can't find him, we're hampered, there's no extradition treaty, those kinds of cases. But here, once the defendant's taken into custody, Askland's a perfect example where the court decides he pleaded, he's back in custody, he's sentenced. They don't seem to hold that delay against the sureties, and that the finding has been the purpose of bail been satisfied. It's rare. I think Reamer's one of the few cases that I've argued, at least at this level, where we actually have a defendant who's not willfully absent from the jurisdiction of the court. The majority of cases where a defendant absconds from jurisdiction, it's willful. It's a rarity that the cases where they're picked up by federal agents or they're deported or removed from the country are rare. More often, I suspect Mr. White knew he was going to prison and just wanted to delay it. I don't know that. And we don't have the opportunity to create that record. Mr. White's in prison. He won't respond to our requests, and I don't blame him. So I agree, Your Honor, that it is a willful violation, but I think weighing all four of the Shetsky factors, the court abused its discretion because it didn't consider the good faith efforts against the willfulness. So that's supposed to be weighed. You know, it's an interesting test, and I'm almost out of time. We have these two factors that are really one, right? The efforts made by the surety in trying to apprehend him and then measuring them against the willfulness of the defendant. I agree with Your Honor. It's difficult to kind of weigh those against each other because it's a rare case where a defendant is absent from the court beyond his will. So I'm out of time. I guess maybe I should just do my five-minute rebuttal.
You have questions? I have a question.
Yes.
I'm unclear on whether when he was first at large, he was arrested on a warrant. I'm unclear whether there was any causal connection between your client's efforts and the law enforcement's ability to find him, or whether it was simply independent.
Our client was cooperating in the investigation and making efforts, but I believe the defendant was apprehended by law enforcement, not by Midwest.
That's my understanding as well, but I guess I'm wondering whether law enforcement found him because of Midwest or whether there was no causal connection at all.
I'm not aware that there was a causal connection, and I can't offer evidence to that fact. But I don't know that that should be dispositive. I think, as the majority of the time a defendant's absent willfully, the majority of the times the defendants are apprehended by law enforcement, they just have so much more resource. And the cases where the surety apprehends the defendant usually don't come up on appeal because in those cases the district court is more inclined to discharge the bond because of that philosophy. They think that because the bond company apprehended him, they don't, for whatever reason, they don't order those bonds forfeited. I don't think it should matter. I think that you should consider the efforts being made and not necessarily who ultimately apprehended him or her.
Thank you, Mr. McGinney, for your arguments. For the reasons I said earlier, the case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you. And that is the final oral argument of the day, so the panel is now adjourned.